Welcome to Radio Who, What, Why. I'm Jeff Scheckman. We've all heard the old adage that what can be done can be undone. Well, maybe we need to try that with our healthcare system. In just 50 years, we've gone from an affordable and human-based system to one that people hate at every level. They may like their individual doctor, but they generally hate the system. Of course, there have been changes and disruption everywhere in our society, but most of it has been to make our lives easier, better, and more efficient, and in many cases, to lower the barriers to entry. In healthcare, it's become less efficient, costlier, less human-centric, higher barriers to entry, and the net result has not been to increase the care or life expectancy of individuals. Instead, it's enriched those at the top of the system, while at the same time being out of step with every system in every other Western nation. This is hardly American exceptionalism. So how did we get here, and how will that knowledge be helpful in trying to sort it out and maybe improving the system? We're going to talk about that today with my guest, Dr. Elizabeth Rosenthal. She spent 22 years as a reporter, correspondent, and senior writer at the New York Times. She is currently the editor-in-chief of Kaiser Health News and has received degrees from Stanford, from Cambridge, and from Harvard. It is my pleasure to welcome Dr. Elizabeth Rosenthal here. Dr. Rosenthal, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Is there a singular point, a time, a rough period that we can identify in which our system changed so dramatically to the kind of business-based profit system that we have today?
Well, I think there's no one point, but it was gradually, and it was growing when I was a resident in the late 80s, where you would see like the leading edge of this. You know, when I started in medical school, there was a head nurse on all wards, and, you know, he or she would lie down in front of a train to protect the patients on the wards. No one would say, oh, you know, insurance won't reimburse one more day, or you can't use that medicine because it's not covered by the policy, or it's too expensive. But, you know, by the time I finished my training, I saw people coming in with clipboards. And when I was practicing in an emergency room, there were more people with MBAs around the hospital. And so that was the leading edge. And at that point, it still may have made sense because hospitals were terribly inefficient places. And a lot of them were hemorrhaging money around that time. And then but I think for me, one of the most pressing moment was around the year 2000, where hospitals start calling in consultants from Deloitte and McKinsey to tell them how to operate better as businesses. And at that point, you see the metrics and the values of business being applied to healthcare. So they'll come into a system and not say, like, how do you improve infection rates? Because, right, McKinsey and Deloitte don't know that. They come in and say, this is how you can make more money by billing for more. So, guys, you know, you could bill for OR time. You could bill for recovery room time. You could bill $17 for that Tylenol pill. Why are you leaving all this money on the table? So suddenly you have the kind of lens of business looking at healthcare as if they were looking at a chicken packing plant or a jet engine plant. And that's where the problem really begins taking off. And of course, once hospitals start billing that way, then the doctors start feeling like, wow, you know, we're the labor here. We're providing the medical goods. And there are, you know, these 20 administrators at my hospital and MBAs. When I'm doing the work, I want more too. So they start upping the charges. And we see in the pharmaceutical world, you know, when the AIDS drugs were introduced in the 1990s, they came into the market around $10,000 a year. And everyone thought, wow, that's a crazy price. That's insane. You know, there was all this pushback. Now that sounds kind of reasonable. So the pharmaceutical manufacturers got in and started upping prices. And, you know, we always thought the generic drugs were inherently cheap. Well, not really. What we're seeing now is the generic drug manufacturers say, you know, gee, why should we only charge pennies for this, you know, 50-year-old antibiotic? Let's do a Martin Shkreli and, you know, increase the price to $5 a pill. And they're getting away with it. And that's really, you know, so it's kind of this inflationary cycle where each part of the system sees the others managing to charge extortionate prices. And because the values of business have taken hold, the poor patients and the poor doctors who are just trying to do the right thing are pretty powerless and feel very stuck.
It does seem that it's almost like a four-legged stool. The patients are not really part of that, but it's in the insurance companies, the hospitals, the doctors, and the drug and pharmaceutical companies, and the way they have all worked together over these past 30, 40 years.
Well, they're often kind of codependent in very unproductive ways that say much more about the business of healthcare than about healthcare itself. I mean, what we find now is that even many of the patient advocacy groups are funded by pharma. So really, what's their message when they're funded by pharma? It's not, gee, why does this drug cost $70,000 a year? It's, why doesn't our insurance pay for it? You know, it's such a distorted kind of inflationary lens to look at healthcare through. In all of these healthcare debates in Washington, at the state level, at companies, no one really is representing the patients and their needs and their distress as they open these bills and face the $5,000 deductible or the 20% copay on insulin that's risen by 400% in the last 10 years. You know, so we need to speak up for our own interests here.
The other thing that seems to have happened at the same time is, almost on purpose, an increasing complexity of all of this, making it more and more difficult for the patient to understand.
Yeah, and I don't think, you know, these things don't happen for business purposes in order to make a profit, but because they make a profit and because they're conducive to making money, there's no resistance to them. So in our system, you know, what you see happening is layers and layers of middlemen introduced. So say, for example, a joint implant. A company is charging $22,000 for that because, hey, there are only four joint manufacturers in the U.S. and some orthopedists like to refer to them as a cartel. You know, they're all charging a lot of money, way more than they charge in other countries, and it's in no one's interest to offer a discounted product. But what happens is the hospital says, wow, that's really expensive. So the hospital hires a joint negotiator who talks to a joint broker, and the manufacturer has a joint salesman. So there, someone calculated that there are 13 middlemen between that joint being produced and it being put into a patient's body. And those are all for-profit companies in the middle. And they're all taking, you know, their 10% cut. So why does a joint end up costing $22,000? Well, because there are a lot of people kind of feeding off that list price. And, you know, we heard it when the CEO of Mylan was taken to the congressional hearing saying, why does the EpiPen cost $600 now? And she said, oh, well, there are all these middlemen, so we don't get that $600. Now, you know, there are two layers of questions there. I mean, first of all, what value do the middlemen serve for those of us patients? And the answer is, you know, little to none. And the second question is, you know, why does an ancient drug put in a fancy new device deserve the same patent as the ancient drug by itself, which is really the life-saving entity? You know, epinephrine is cheap. EpiPrens are hugely expensive just because epinephrine is in kind of a cool new package. And that may have some value. It's a slightly, you know, it's easier to use than a syringe and a little vial of epinephrine. But $200, $400, not if we were paying out of pocket. And I think that's why we're seeing people squawking now, because with high deductibles and copays, we are seeing these prices now. We are feeling them. And we weren't a few years ago when our insurance was covering things better. So now we see this widespread outrage at healthcare and healthcare costs. We see at the town hall meetings people standing up and going, you know, don't take away my insurance. I can't afford this. I'm being, you know, I'm being devastated. I haven't gotten a raise in 10 years. Why? Because your employer has been increasingly paying more and more to health insurance costs.
Is there a tipping point in all of this? Is there a point that you can see where the system just collapses under its own financial weight?
Well, you know, I had thought, I would have thought over the last few years we'd reached that tipping point. I mean, people spending 20 to 30% of their household income on healthcare costs, that to me is pretty near that tipping point. People not getting raises for 10 years because of healthcare costs, that should create a tipping point. But I think we haven't adequately connected all these hardships to things that are fixable, that we don't have to put up with. You know, we've accepted this narrative of, well, healthcare is expensive, we're doing really important, valuable things for you, we have no choice but to pay this much for the drug, otherwise we won't get drug development. This is not necessary, and we're not getting results that are better than anywhere else in the world. In fact, for many diseases, studies show we're getting worse results. So don't just take this narrative, oh, we have the best healthcare and it has to cost this much because it's so very valuable. Well, no. You know, we're paying 2 to 3 times as much as people in the rest of the world. I don't expect us to overnight get to any of those levels, but certainly we can turn the ship around and not be not taking summer vacations or going bankrupt or having our credit ratings dinged because of these really outrageous costs.
To some extent, it's hard to imagine that except for anyone that is in the system and profiting from the system, that there can be any legitimate defenders of this current system.
Well, you know, certainly many, many physicians feel extremely uncomfortable with this system. They do not think their patients are getting value, and it bothers them. You know, there's one group of physicians who are a bunch of surgeons in northern Wisconsin, red state, you know, red area for sure. And one of them said to me, you know, I always felt like I was helping people by taking out their appendix. And then a patient came in to me and said, Doc, you know, I feel better, but I just got this bill for $25,000 and I can't afford it. And this doctor, Hans Reichsteiner, said to me, you know, I'd always felt good about being a physician, and then I realized in saving his life, I'd bankrupted his family. And so, no, you know, doctors, many of the good doctors in the system are so stressed by what's going on. So who are the defenders? You know, you hear them certainly come from pharma. You hear them come from some of the hospital executives who say, you know, what else can we do? Well, you look around the hospital and you say, gee, maybe you didn't have to buy the new wing. Maybe you could have reduced the bills, or maybe you don't need a curator and all this art. Maybe you should not charge so much for your outpatient surgery center. You know, the defenders tend to be people who are profiting from the system, not the people who are just, and there are many people in the system who are just trying to deliver good health care. And that's, to me, the essential problem, that the values of health care are patients, you know, helping people, caring. The values of business are efficiency, revenue generation, profit maximization. And, you know, a lot of the people involved in our healthcare system are profit driven. And the values of medicine and the values of business intersect sometimes, but many times they don't.
Are we seeing any difference at all when we look at the world? There is a separate world of nonprofit medicine, of nonprofit hospitals. When we look at those, is anything any different?
Well, that's a really hard one to answer, because certainly there are many nonprofits in the healthcare right. world, like community clinics, that are doing amazing work and struggling to do so. There are also small rural hospitals that are struggling to do so. But look at all, 2/3 of hospitals or more in this country are technically nonprofit. They do not look like any other nonprofit on earth, I would say. You know, their executives are paid millions and millions of dollars. Often the highest paid nonprofit executive in a city is the hospital CEO. They tend to be now more MBAs than physicians, which is a big change from 25 years ago. So I think, You know, I would like to see more nonprofits in the healthcare space, but I'd like them to be real nonprofits. And I think one thing that I encourage all patients to do is look at their local hospital's tax form. Because they're nonprofits, they have to file something called a Schedule H on their 990 tax form, and it will tell you what your hospital is doing for your community to deserve not paying any taxes. And I think most of us will find that very unsatisfying. So, yes, nonprofits in healthcare are a good idea. In many countries, like in Germany, there's a rule that all insurers have to be not-for-profit. I don't know that we're ready to go there, but those sectors which are nonprofit, we should demand that they give us real value, that they serve the communities. And I would love to see more nonprofit insurers. The Affordable Care Act created a bunch of them through the state insurance cooperatives. Many of them failed because, frankly, because the Congress was never really funded them adequately to function as health insurers.
We're just about out of time. Let me ask you, do you have any reason to think, given the current climate, medical climate, political climate, all the various forces that we've touched on here, that anything is going to change in this system anytime soon?
I do think there's hope, but I think we're looking to the wrong place if we're looking to Washington for a solution right now. There's a lot that individuals can do to reduce their own health care costs, things to ask your doctor, ways to question the hospital, even templates of letters you can use to assert your patient rights. That will save you money, but also it will send a message to this health care system that we are not just going to accept these prices anymore. We want much better. We want more reasonable prices and far greater transparency. But also at the state level, there's an enormous amount that state insurance regulators can do, for example. They can say those directories, which we all know now are horribly inaccurate, have to be accurate up to this week, up to this month. Most state insurance directors now are taken from the insurance industry, but they really should be patient advocates, and many of those are elected positions. So let's start electing state insurance commissioners who serve our interests. We see a number of states playing around with different innovations. Some are single payer, some are drug price regulations. I suspect that much progress in healthcare now, as we saw for issues like gay marriage or legalizing medical marijuana, will come at the state level, and we'll see if that coalesces into a bigger national movement. But states can do an awful lot. I mean, healthcare is, if nothing else, it's local. It's local, and the courts can break up these local conglomerates. You can go to your local hospital and ask for better. We do have power at the state and local and individual level as long as we choose to speak up and exercise it, and I think we all should.
Elizabeth Rosenthal. Elizabeth, I thank you so much for spending time with us.
Sure. I help people get more for what they pay for their health care. We all deserve it.
Thank you so much. Thank you for listening and joining us here on Radio Who, What, Why. I hope you join us next week for another Radio Who, What, Why podcast. I'm Jeff Shechtman. If you like this podcast, please feel free to share and help others find it by rating and reviewing it on iTunes. You can also support this podcast and all the work we do by going to whowhatwhy.org/donate.